It is not a made-up word, I promise you. Pronking is the way that deer spring into the air as they take flight. I get to see pronking every Saturday morning on my way in here before the programme, because at that time of the morning there are Sika deer everywhere on the roads. The population has exploded in the last few years. So back in 2022, the government appointed a strategy group and just this week awarded a management contract to a co-op to set up 15 local deer management units around the country. Deer densities in counties Wicklow, Tipperary, Waterford, Donegal and Galway are above sustainable and are impacting not just on farming and forestry, but they're also having a bad effect on nature conservation and on biodiversity. Now, the idea of a deer cull is obviously emotive to some, and they will argue that nature should be left to take its course. So, this week, I got a range of opinions about what the cost of that would be.
Why did you plant native broadleaf?
It's an investment in nature and biodiversity. You're talking about these oak trees. Should it be 100 years before they reach any maturity?
Since planting 30,000 native broadleafs, oak, alder, beech, holly, 7 years ago, Chris Maloney has seen Wicklow's Sika deer do their best to undermine his efforts at nature restoration.
And at what stage do you think that they won't be vulnerable to the deer anymore?
I'd say 10 to 15 with some of the species.
So you really have to mollycoddle and be very precious with them.
They're like rearing children.
Except you've got 30,000 of them.
From that wood over there, you could see 60, 70 deer approaching. The stalkers have told me they've counted up to 90 to 100 in packs.
And how many were you seeing trapped inside your plantation fence?
At the start of the forestry, there was probably about 30. We got them down to about 5. And the jigs and the reels, over 2 years, it took us to eliminate them. Didn't totally eliminate them because... There's new ones coming in.
How many trees did you lose?
4,000 approximately.
Were you expecting that level of loss?
I had no idea what I was getting into. You can see the 6-foot fence that was originally put in.
Solid, well built. Wire is still taut. 6 foot wasn't enough, was it?
In places it wasn't good enough where they could get a run at it. So they had to come back and go to 8 foot.
The open field behind them has a downhill run, so they were able to take a running lap at it.
A running lap at it and successfully cleared it.
6 feet.
So they had to carry on 8 foot from there, nearly all around the 30 acres. They either decided to go over it or burrow under it. The little prickets kept popping at it, popping at it, popping at it, till they eventually forged their way through.
And there were places deer just throw themselves at the fence.
Absolutely, yeah. They'll just keep at it and at it till they get to where they want to go to.
Anybody who thinks that you just plant the trees, put up a fence and walk away is in for a bit of a rude shock.
Not going to happen. Not going to happen. Not going to happen.
Jane Stout is a professor of botany in Trinity College. We went to look at a 10-acre unfenced patch of native woodland that the deer are free to roam through as they please.
So there's no sheep have access to this little spot. What's your first impression?
First impression, we've got a lot of young trees in here. But they're all of a very similar age stage.
And they're all birch, which, as we know, would grow on Mars.
So very little diversity in terms of the species, very little diversity in terms of the age, and very little ground cover. So we're not seeing the ground flora that you'd expect. Like I say, hard to say at this time of year when things are only just starting to pop through anyway. That must be a bit of
wild garlic,
isn't it? Yeah.
Which would also grow on Mars in abundance.
Absolutely. But there's little diversity here. So when you've got a high pressure of grazers like the Sika deer, then they do take out the ground flora.
And when you look down, if we hunker down here, you can see that these little bits of lichen moss have actually been grazed.
Yeah, ends have been taken off. So, you know, they'll be grazing on the stuff that's coming out of the ground, the soft, sweet, young shoots. So for the trees, in terms of any regeneration of the trees, they'll graze the seedlings because they'll be easier to eat. They're less heavily defended than an older tree. So that's where you don't get the regeneration of the trees. But also they're taking out the ground flora. I don't know what the palatability is of the wild garlic, but it may be that they avoid that. And so you end up with this reduction in diversity. Mm-hmm. One of the problems with invasive grazers like the seeker deer is if they graze out all the stuff that's tasty and leave the stuff that's not tasty. And that becomes a problem when the stuff that's not tasty is also non-native. So that's when you get problems with things like rhododendron. So they'll graze out everything else and leave the rhododendron seedlings because they're not tasty.
Oh dear. Are you okay?
Slippy
because there isn't actually that much vegetation holding the ground together.
Yes, I just discovered that.
So does that mean that an area like this is more prone to soil erosion and that soil ending up in the river precisely because there isn't that much vegetation down
under our feet? So when there's lots of vegetation in the ground and all the roots are holding the soil together, that's when vegetation can help to prevent soil erosion. So if you lose your vegetation, you lose those rooting structures that are holding the soil together, and that's when the soil washes away.
And it helps keep scientists on their feet.
It keeps me on my toes.
What's the longest you've ever waited? Or is it more usual to go home empty-handed?
You could be just as easy going home empty-handed. It's absolutely a lottery in some respects.
Ed Hick is a deer stalker. He shoots for the pot. Up until now, population management has been left in the main to people like Ed. And it is a long and a labour-intensive process that can't keep abreast of the birth rate.
How long, how many man hours does it take Ed Hick to take one deer down off the hills?
In real terms, I think you could probably think about a day and a half.
For one?
For one. That's processing, that's taking it home, that's cutting it up, that's preparing it for the freezer.
So several hours of a stalk, grollicking it on the side of the hill, carrying it back down to your car.
Yeah, all of that sort of stuff. And all of that has to take place, if you like, in your free time.
And how many amateur stalkers or hunters are there in the country?
Well, there are 6,500 licences issued each year. Last year, I think the numbers were, there was 78,000 deer taken. So that would be on average 10 per person.
And how much further north of 78,000 does that number need to be to get the population under control?
I think nobody has any idea, Philip, which is the key point here.
Because we don't know how many there are.
We don't know how many there are. So for you, I, or anybody else to say we need to reduce the population by 20%, what does that mean? We don't know what the population is. For us to say, what we do know is that they will multiply by approximately 30% per year if they're left on their own.
This particular landowner has given permission for people to shoot deer on his land.
Yeah.
But neighbouring landowners might not. How big a problem is it that the deer can just run away, jump over a hedge and sit there sticking their tongue out at you?
The reality of it is, however diligent this particular landowner's programme is, if his next door neighbour has no programme in place, that's where the deer are going to go. They'll go where it's safe. And they'll come out and eat where they come out and eat. So it's really how much pressure they feel under and how much threat they feel under is going to determine where they are.
So there will be no effective population control unless a quantum, who knows what that number is, but the majority of landowners in an area say, yes, you can come and shoot on my land.
Pretty much, because otherwise all the deer will just go onto that one particular patch of land and come out from there every evening.
What do you say to the people who have an ethical problem with shooting any of these animals at all and say, we should just allow nature to take its course?
I think the reality of it is, if you look at areas, for example, up above Glendalough in the National Park, the herd sizes up there are staggering. That's them effectively being left alone. What does that do for biodiversity? They just eat pretty much everything, like, to be honest with you. If it grows, they'll eat it.
What reassurance can you then offer to the people who have their reservations about this whole process, that it is done humanely?
Well, licences are issued in Ireland is the first thing. So, you know, there are people, obviously, who take matters into their own hands. But the licensed hunters, the people who are licensed by, you know, by the Parks and Wildlife, there are hunter competent assessment programs. So there is training, there is education involved. Recognising deer and deer behaviour that people have to do, there's an exam, you know.
And where an animal ends up being wounded and not taken down with the first shot, do you guys commit yourselves to finding that animal and making sure that it doesn't suffer?
Well, any responsible shooter would, yeah, they'd have to. Anybody who's gone to the trouble of going through the not insignificant hoops of getting a licence in Ireland, they're committed. You know, they're keen on it. They want the best.
Ed Hick, one of the part-time stalkers on whose back previous deer population control strategies were built, but clearly relying on their efforts is no longer enough, which is why a working group was formed 2 years ago. And arising from their recommendations, the government has just awarded a tender to the Co-op Farm Relief Services to set up 15 deer management groups around the country to control the population on a more full-time basis. The chairman of the working group is Teddy Cashman, who joins us this morning with one eye being cast over a busy calving shed. Can you take your eye off the shed for 5 minutes, Teddy? Everything going okay?
Yeah, well, we just got the calving camera fixed this minute, and I can see it now from where I am in the office, but the eye needs to be kept on things on an ongoing basis. Now things are pretty hectic for the last 3 weeks, I suppose.
All right, so if you end up sounding a bit distracted in this interview, we'll understand why.
No, there's nothing imminent, don't worry.
Ed Hick was saying there that no one really has any idea of the size of the population. How big a surprise was that to you when you started your work?
I suppose, yeah, when I started 2 years ago, I asked for what a national figure was, and they said it was 600,000 deer, plus or minus 200,000 that time. And that was the best guesstimate they could do. And, you know, that's an irrelevant figure when you have that percentage up and down on a figure. It is meaningless, really.
So if we don't know how many there are, Teddy, how on earth would anybody ever be able to decide what is the right number to shoot each year?
I suppose you have to start very much on the whole idea of impacts and what impacts are happening in an area. And you spoke about the biodiversity in places there a few minutes ago. And where there's a serious biodiversity impact, you know that you're going to have to go into that area and be more enhanced in your efforts than you would be in an area where there's less impacts. The same scenario where you have lots of road accidents and persistent road accidents in an area, you know that your populations are out of control there also. The other thing is that, you know, drone technology and infrared drone technology is being developed quite, is probably the future here, really, I suppose, Philip. And in local areas and in local deer management units, that it's an option to be able to get some handle on the numbers. But that technology is only coming to fruition now, but it is up and active and it is a possibility.
And if you put the drones up at night and you use thermal infrared, yeah, you get to see them when they have come out of the forest and come out of the covers. We also heard there, talking to Ed, how unless all of the landowners in an area get on board, the deer are just going to be able to evade the scope of the hunter's rifle. How would you encourage enough people to allow shooting on their land to make the difference that you need to make?
I suppose deer management units are very much about collaboration. They won't work otherwise. So each unit is a collaboration between the hunters, the farmers, the foresters, all those impacted by deer in a particular area. So there's going to need to be quite a lot of public engagement with people in a local area, that people understand what's happening and are very clear on what the issues are. And if people know what's happening and they know who's doing what and they know what the targets are and what the outcome is, the perceived outcome or the desired outcome is going to be, you have a much better chance of getting people on board. And we have engaged with all of the farming organisations, all of the hunting organisations, the foresters, anybody in ecology who wants to take part is also welcome. So they can, you know, that it's a collaboration is the only way this is going to work. But for that, people need to have good information on the ground. They need to know who's doing what. and they need to be part of the process.
And do you think
that there are outsiders coming into their area?
Do you think that at the moment the best strategy is to persuade rather than to compel?
Oh, I think you don't have any other option, really, to be honest, Philip. It's a persuasion scenario.
Okay.
And look, you know, human nature being as it is, you will have pockets where it won't happen to the extent you want it to, but you're going to have to do your very best to have an overall positive outcome. But there will be work in engagement on that.
In order not to be wasteful, it seems kind of obvious that we should try and develop a venison market off the back of increased hunting. But did you find that that is something that is easier said than done?
For sure. I suppose there's a couple of issues around the venison one. It's not probably a meat that's widely eaten in Ireland, and where it is eaten, it's generally eaten in a restaurant setting. And there hasn't been a great culture of eating venison. So, I mean, we have engaged with Board Bia as part of the subcommittee process around this, and they have been involved in the venison subcommittee here with us as well. And it is something that will be a slow burner, but will need to be engaged with. But you're going to end up, you know, moving venison to various different options if you're going to get rid of the amount that you're going to need to do if you're going to do an enhanced management program around deer.
I understand, though, that the issue at the moment is that the huge amount of labour involved in getting one deer off the side of a hill is not really rewarded by the price that is paid for it.
Absolutely, yeah. And prices at this time of the year tend to fall once you come into the spring. And venison, for the last number of years, has been selling around €2 a kilo in the first half of the season and has dropped in a lot of places, about €1.50 at the moment, which hunters find uneconomic once you get into February and March.
Now, I have absolutely no doubt that the RTE switchboard is already lighting up with the people who are horrified listening to this at the thought of the taxpayer funding a cull of any wild animals. What would you say to them?
Well, I would say to them, I suppose you need balance in society. What we're hoping to do here is to get to a sustainable level of deer population. You're not trying to take out the deer out of the wild. What you're trying to do is to maintain a population at a level that is sustainable. And I've often cited the scenario around Phoenix Park. People are well aware that there is a herd of deer in Phoenix Park, but they are managed every year to make sure the numbers stay at a certain level. And everybody gets to enjoy the wildlife in Phoenix Park on that basis because they're not allowed to grow out of control. So what you're there is no natural predator. So what you need to do is get levels to the deer numbers to an acceptable level where biodiversity can flourish. Forestry can regenerate and deer will have enough to eat generally. At the moment, in some places, the deer are being impacted by a lack of nutrition because of a lack of, you know, there are too many in an area and there isn't enough for them to eat.
Teddy Cashman, back to the calving with you, and thank you very much for your time and thoughts this morning.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.